This is KPTZ, Port Townsend, 91.9 FM on your radio dial. If you want to listen to us online, go to kptz.org. You can listen to today's show live online, but you can also sample some of our earlier shows, which are online as podcasts. In fact, much of the original programming on KPTZ is available as podcasts. You know, double your listening pleasure. Hear the show today as well as some earlier ones. I'm Marianne McNellis, and this show is called Our Town. Have you ever wondered who the people are that you see every day around the area? Who is that ramrod straight Victorian lady slowly pedaling her bicycle around town? It's obvious she wears a corset. No one could possibly sit up that straight without whalebone or steel in a corset. And then there's the group of guys who play endless games of pool at the community center. Who are they when they go home at night? And have you ever considered the cop that slowly patrols the streets at 3 a.m. in the morning? What is he looking for? Maybe it's this year's crop of fawns, which are really no bigger than Cocker Spaniels. This show, Our Town, profiles some of the fascinating people who live and work in Jefferson County. We talk with people who make up the eclectic mix around here. We talk about their lives, their dreams, and how they ended up on the western edge of the continent, able to look across the Strait of Juan de Fuca, right at Vancouver Island. Over time, we'll be talking with firefighters and foodies, bus drivers and teenage beauty queens. We try to find out what makes them tick and what they think about living in beautiful Jefferson County amid the deer, otters, and the soaring eagles. Listening to Our Town is a way to meet some of Port Townsend's authentic and even eclectic people. Your neighbors, your friends, particularly the people you don't know yet, but you'd like to meet them. Today's guest is Daniel Evans, who has one of the most intriguing business cards I've ever seen. The card features snow-capped mountains in the background, and Daniel has a great title. He's not president or chief financial officer or anything corporate like that. He's called Race Boss. Daniel is the race boss for the Race to Alaska, more frequently called R2AK. Surely you've seen the t-shirts and hats already. Most of our listeners know about last year's inaugural Race to Alaska. It seemingly came out of nowhere to become a huge internet hit. During the race, the website recorded a staggering 11 million hits, or 25,000 hits per hour. This year's race, which starts on June 23rd, is predicted to draw even more attention globally. This is the race that insiders call the America's Cup for Dirtbaggers. Daniel's business card explains the whole thing. It reads, quote, "Get a boat without a motor. Race 750 miles to Alaska any way you can. Don't get eaten by a bear. $10,000 if you're first, and a set of steak knives if you're second." The Race to Alaska is a legit project. It's part of the Northwest Maritime Center, which is a 501c nonprofit headquartered right here in Port Townsend. But let's start back at the beginning. Daniel, are you a Port Townsend native?
I'm not a Port Townsend native, though I live here now. I'm from Anchorage, Alaska. That's where I grew up. I've been in this present incarnation. I've been living in Port Townsend for 4 years and another 4 years earlier in my life.
So, Alaska, I've never been there, but I understand it's a little different. What was it like when you first saw the lower 48?
It was incredible. Things like fresh vegetables in the winter was something I had never encountered. Traffic, even in the worst times, wasn't anything like I'd ever seen. Cities, really. Anchorage is the biggest city in Alaska, and it only held about 200,000 people while I was growing up.
What about the weather?
Then the weather was too hot all the time. And it was when I was young, and I traveled down with my father for one of the first times I'd been in the lower 48s. I was in Portland in the summer, and actually the humidity got to me to a point in which I earnestly and truly felt I was going to die and ended up climbing into a cooler in a 7-Eleven, and my father had to drag me out because I thought it was life or death that I stayed in there until winter.
A little bit embarrassing, but very funny, really. I don't know whether you thought it was funny at the time. Probably not.
Absolutely not.
Okay, so did you go to high school in Alaska?
Yeah.
And what sort of crowd did you hang out with?
I would say the athletic crowd. I did a lot of sports. I wasn't necessarily enthralled with high school, and found a great outlet in the variety of sports that they offered, and it kept me busy.
Which ones were you into?
It was baseball, football, track, tennis, and wrestling.
Okay, that certainly runs the gamut there.
Yeah.
And so were you one of these kids that was very focused and knew exactly what you wanted to do when you grew up?
Yeah, not at all.
Okay.
I think the only thing I knew that I wanted to find out after I graduated high school was what it meant to be an American. I really had no idea. Living in Alaska, most of my time in Alaska, we didn't even have cable TV, so I didn't know what people were watching. I didn't know current affairs. A place like New York was as fantastical as any fantasy city or book that I'd ever read. I left Alaska and came down to Washington State, where my grandparents lived, and bought a Harley and just tried to cruise as much of the country as I could to see what being an American really meant.
Wow. And were you all by yourself during this adventure?
Yeah, for the most part, I was. Yes, a couple transplant friends who are starting to go to college or had moved for various reasons I would visit, but by and large, it was just kind of cruising the country and looking at things, talking with people.
Getting to know your country.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so how did you decide that adventure was over?
I ran out of money.
Yes, that's a clue, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, this happens to all of us. I think at some point we realize we have to eat and pay rent and inconvenient stuff like that. So what did you decide to do then?
I ran out of money. I ended up selling my Harley so I could continue just to live without work. Mm-hmm. But finally, I ended up back at my grandparents in Washington State, you know, down in Gig Harbor, where they let me stay until I could figure out what I would do. And I ended up being a bike courier for a while in Seattle and a high-rise window washer, and got to a point where a decision had to be made, and it was to go to college or not to go to college. And I actually couldn't decide. So it was a flip of a quarter, and heads was go to school. It landed on heads, so I went to school.
Was anyone in the room when you flipped the coin?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Ah, so you had witnesses. You couldn't sort of back out.
No, yeah, exactly right. I couldn't back out.
Who were your witnesses?
A bunch of friends. There was a bunch of Alaskan transplants that we were all living in a house on Delridge Way in Seattle.
Okay, and so off to college you went.
Yeah, off to Evergreen, and I studied environmental sciences and literature.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. And so you graduated and there were many jobs dangling in front of you.
All over. All these high-paying and wonderful jobs. Mm-hmm. I came out of college actually employed, but not in a way that I ever thought I would be, because during those years going to school, I was climbing a lot, mountain climbing and rock climbing. And one time in Southern California, in Joshua Tree, I was climbing in the middle of nowhere and ran into somebody who told me about Outward Bound, an expeditionary, adventure-based, experiential outdoor school. They were opening up a base camp in Anacortes, Washington, and it was a sea base camp. And I had done a lot of sailing up until then. And I joined up with them because I thought, wow, I can get paid to go sailing. I started up with them. I almost quit the first day because the boats were so slow. I thought there's no way I could do this, and the students, so hard to work with, but pretty quickly fell in love with it. And
how, you know, I've never done an Outward Bound experience, but I know a lot of people who have. Do they vary in length and intensity, or is it a standard package? What do you get?
They vary in length and intensity. The school that I worked with was a wilderness base, and so they really liked the students to essentially meet at the trailhead or meet at the boat. They never saw a town. They stayed in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in the mountains and in the water. And it's funny because the Race of Alaska is very much like this. It's essentially you take what you have and you learn to survive. You learn to get your objectives met through what you found and what you have on the boat and the team that you create. And the tighter the team, the higher performing, the more you can get done. And in Outward Bound, you know, I helped instruct people in moving through those phases of storming and norming and then, you know, performing and becoming this team that could really achieve great things.
How big were the groups?
The group, 12 students and two instructors.
And were they typically a group when they got there, like coming out of the same company, or were they random people?
Though that was a program that Outward Bound offered, kind of corporate development. The ones that I did almost exclusively were we call open enrollment, and it was a policy that no one knew each other. Oftentimes in the beginning of a trip, we would offer for people to pick a name, and it didn't have to be their real name, because we said that this was a chance that you can be the person you've always wanted to be, not the person that you've been expected to be, or not the person that you've been told that you are, that this was a chance to reach for something greater.
That's interesting. And how many people, roughly, what percentage, took up the idea of having a different name and person?
Almost all of them.
Really?
Yeah.
So if your name was Daniel, you could go be Fred or whatever you wanted to.
Absolutely, yeah, whatever you wanted. People would pick bird names. They would pick names of rockets or planets. And and in a day or two, you didn't even think of them as anything else. And it really did. It set the stage that allowed people to do things they never imagined they could do.
Wow, amazing. So how long were you with Outward Bound?
12 years I was with Outward Bound. And it was seasonal, so I would spend my time in between that, sometimes traveling, sometimes doing boat deliveries. A lot of that time I spent climbing and skiing and just living out of my car, which was fun.
Moving around, or did you stay in Washington State pretty much?
I stayed on the West Coast pretty much, in the North Cascades and Mazama, but also back east at it's called Thompson Island Outward Bound. I was their marine operations manager, and so I controlled the waterfront, all the boats, trained all the instructors.
Wow. It sounds like a really fun job / experience. What persuaded you to leave?
Change. There's always a need for change. And also, I had a growing love for teaching and other modalities, as well as larger ships. And so during that time, near the end, I started sailing on much larger schooners, essentially. So big, two-masted, windjammers, usually wood, usually very old.
How do you find opportunities like that, or do they find you?
Sometimes I feel like I've been kind of lazy in life, because these things come to me and I say, okay, I'll take them. And there's a few times that I've actually forced my way into some other position. But when I reflect on my life, I feel very lucky. I feel like I've had rich positions that support not just my lifestyle, but kind of the ethos of the way of living I want to believe in and live. Maybe it's when I'm feeling down and negative, it feels lazy. I think mostly I feel really blessed.
So during your last years with Outward Bound, you said it's seasonal, so you had time off to be on schooners and other mm-hmm. things. And then did you just sort of transition out of Outward Bound, or was there an abrupt parting of the ways, or what happened?
Yeah, there was a final season.
Yeah.
And Thompson Island went through some really dramatic changes, and they weren't changes that I really appreciated, and the culture kind of fragmented. Mm. And I felt that it was a good time to step out of that and try and step into a culture a little more healthy, full-time. Mm-hmm. And that's when I kind of transitioned out of it.
And where did you head next?
Schooners. You know, lots of different schooners. A lot of them on the East Coast.
When you're with a schooner, is it, you know, just for a specific trip, or is it a year-round occupation? How does it work?
Some schooners are different. A lot of them hire, like, say, in a four-month season, and then you could hire on again. As you move into the officer ranks and then into the captain rank, you get more permanent positions. Mm-hmm. My final positions, before I stepped into the race boss one, I was the captain of Adventurous for 5 years, the local schooner that's been around forever.
Everyone around here knows the Adventurous.
She's great, isn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, beautiful.
And for a few years, I was captain of a schooner during the winters down in the Bahamas.
Well, that would have been fun, too.
That was not shabby.
Yeah. Now, the Adventurous, I don't really understand the schedule. I know she's around here a lot of the time, but what happens?
She's an educational nonprofit that really serves the whole greater Puget Sound area and up north, more of the Salish Sea. So they go where the students are. And so they'll spend a lot of their season in the beginning of the season down in Puget Sound during the school year. It's Seattle, Olympia, Tacoma. They'll come up here a little bit. But they do go where a lot of the population centers are, so they can serve a lot of those students. And then in the summer, they're almost exclusively for a month and a half, 2 months, they are operating out of the San Juan Islands doing overnight trips. So they'll do anything from 3 to 5 day overnight trips. And those are with students too. A lot of groups come from other states at that time. Mm-hmm. And then they'll slowly make their way back down to Puget Sound at the start of the next season and end up here in October.
Well, when you're captain of the Adventurous, did you live aboard?
2 weeks on, 2 weeks off.
I see. Because, you know, when I was on it once, and, you know, toured around it and looked, and some of the sleeping quarters seemed very uncomfortable to me.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. I would say she has tight quarters.
Tight.
Probably the tightest that I've ever needed to live in on a schooner or any boat. There is a captain's cabin.
Oh, and so okay. Well, I don't think I got to see that. I remember seeing these ledges that people were supposed to, and they were sort of stacked up.
That's right.
How many ledges would there be up each side?
9 on each side in the main cabin and more up forward. The boat sleeps 24 for overnight programs.
Huh.
And so, yeah, I call it festival sleeping. Yeah, it's just on benches going up. There's no curtains or anything. And the crew it's a great culture aboard that boat. It is the best, most intentional and compassionate and loving culture on any vessel I've ever been on.
Huh.
And it's definitely one of the things that kept me there that long.
Yeah, that would have been an excellent adventure. How did you decide to leave that?
You know, it's sometimes things, it just needs to happen. But a few years ago, I had a daughter with my lovely wife, Mary Lee. And my daughter, who is now just getting ready to turn 4,
mm-hmm.
spending 2 weeks away from her was very, very hard. And so I'd say, you know, we call it swallowing the anchor, when you kind of give up going to sea and you root down somewhere. So I swallowed the anchor about a year and a half ago, I guess. And the relationship to my daughter has been growing and better ever since. I couldn't be more happy for the choice.
Mm-hmm. Well, Port Townsend's not a shabby place to swallow the anchor.
Isn't it the best? I know, it's fantastic.
Yeah, pretty amazing place.
Yes.
So you were also involved with the Wooden Boat School, correct?
I wasn't involved with I know a lot of people at the Wooden Boat School. I've done some small consulting for them, but I never really worked for them full time.
Okay. So did you go straight from the Adventurous to the Race to Alaska?
I did. And maybe you're thinking I was intimately involved with the Wooden Boat Foundation.
Ah, okay, yeah.
Which was essentially the first iteration of the Northwest Maritime Center. The Wooden Boat Foundation at the Cupola House back in the day in Point Hudson operated. I was their education program director.
Okay, that's what I was thinking of. It's the semantics of the Wooden Boat Foundation and the Wooden Boat School. Yeah, okay.
There's a lot of wooden boat in this community.
Yeah, a lot of wooden boat around
it's hard
here.
It's to keep track for sure.
Okay, so you were doing educational programs for them.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah,
okay.
Running their education programs, developing new and managing the boat shop.
And so does the Wooden Boat Foundation actually still exist, or did it just flip the name over to the Northwest Maritime Center?
Well, the Wooden Boat Foundation actually created the Northwest Maritime Center as a nonprofit. They eventually merged after the Wooden Boat Foundation had some real financial struggles some 14 years ago. I would say by name, the Wooden Boat Foundation still exists. It's the programs represent themselves as from the Wooden Boat Foundation. They share everything to such a degree that they are definitely one. Legally, both still exist, but the Northwest Maritime Center is the parent nonprofit for the Wooden Boat Foundation.
Okay, I get it now.
Yeah.
The new building is the representation of the dream, right?
That's correct. The years of hard labor to try and build the hope was a community institution in the maritime world and training that would allow people within the community and outside of the community greater access to water and learning about our kind of watery world. And I'd say it's been really successful, especially since Jake Beattie, the executive director, came on a few years ago. He's done, I think, wonderful things in making it an accessible organization to everyone.
Okay. You're listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. The show is called Our Town. I'm your host, Marianne McNellis. My guest today, Daniel Evans, who's the race boss for the upcoming Race to Alaska. This race is only in its second year of operation, but it's phenomenally successful. We've been talking about Daniel's life leading up to his involvement with the Race to Alaska. So tell me, what happened? How did you come on board, so to speak?
It's funny. So Jake Beattie, who I mentioned before, is an old friend of mine. We actually lived together in Port Townsend for quite a while with his then-girlfriend, now-wife, Jean. He had the idea for the Race to Alaska in the beer tent at the Wooden Boat Festival a number of years ago.
Wonderful place to get ideas.
Isn't it? It's the perfect spot. The perfect spot. And as he was starting to form it and moving forward with making it happen, yet still the structure of it wasn't created. The idea of it was in place. There was a website in place, but the kind of the ground truth hadn't been laid. And this was a year and a half ago. We ran into each other crossing the street around lunchtime in the rain. And he knew that I was no longer with the Schooner Adventurous. And he mm-hmm. said, I hear you have some time on your hands. You may be looking to make some money. And I said, well,
could be.
And he said, how about the race to Alaska? And I said, it is the best, worst idea I've ever heard. And I love it. And I'd love to be part of it. And he was nice enough to say that he thought I was probably one of the few people that could do it and the one he wanted the most, too. And so I came on as the race boss, I guess the January before the first race.
Okay,
and so put it together.
I know this is an incredibly difficult question because I'm going to ask you to say it in a relatively short amount of time, but how did you pull together the first one?
Well, it was a lot of community involvement and a lot of agency involvement. To make it safe, I realized a really good way to do that was to involve our search and rescue, our Coast Guard, and other things. And they created an exercise over the first stage from here to Victoria that really helped ensure people were safe in the traffic lanes. But it was through a ton of communication, transparency, information sharing through all of the agencies throughout between here and Ketchikan. And I asked advice of a lot of people, like the head of search and rescue for all of British Columbia, Susan Pickrell. I would say, this is the plan I've put together. Will you take a look at it? And she was great because she knew the more prepared I was, the easier it would be for her to do her job. And I had some great risk management advisors to work with me. And so it was, to make it safe, was a really exciting and a compelling thing for me to do. But it worked out really, really well that first year.
So how many boats did you have the first year?
The first year we had going all the way to Ketchikan was 35 boats, and there was 20 some odd boats that were just doing the first leg.
Okay. I understand that there were, when you first left Port Townsend, it wasn't smooth sailing exactly.
Yeah, right.
What happened?
The wind was so tremendous, and it looked calm in Port Townsend Bay, but the wind was piping through the Strait of Juan de Fuca. We started the race, and in the first 7 minutes, 5 boats dropped out. And
wow.
Due to dismastings, rudder failures, one was swamped. A couple had the real smarts to know their boat couldn't take it because up at Point Wilson, the seas were tremendous, tremendous. It was current against tide. And so it was a day of serious attrition, but that was what that leg was designed for. And I had the safety framework in place that we easily took care of everyone really safely.
Okay, so tell me, how's it shaping up for this year? How many boats do you have?
It's really fantastic. We have 66 total right now, and so 44 at the line will be trying to go to Ketchikan, 21 trying to just get up to Victoria to be part of the party and the challenge.
Right, and I understand, what did you tell me, you have 8 Canadian teams?
8 Canadian teams, that's correct. We have 8 Canadian teams. We have one team that has come all the way from France and built a boat just for it, a boat manufacturer, built a boat just for it. A number of boats have been custom built for it, including one locally by Turnpoint Design, the owner Brandon. He built it last year, modified it for this year, and is coming out again this year.
Hmm. How many people are going solo?
You know, I can't remember the exact number of the people going solo. Maybe 5, I think, going all the way solo, 6.
Including a paddleboard?
A stand-up paddleboard, yep, heading up there, man by the name of Carl Kruger.
He's got guts.
He's got something.
yeah, exactly.
I mean, I do have to say we vet the people. We don't let just anyone in. And so Carl is one of the most qualified people I could imagine to try it in a paddleboard.
Yeah, and that's an important thing for our listeners to understand. You don't just show up. I mean, you are vetted. There's a charge as well. It's not astronomical. Would you say to go to Ketchikan, $750 for the boat, $75 per crew member?
That's correct.
And the people who are only going to Victoria, it's $75 and $75. So financially, it's not that onerous. But you are making sure these people know what they're doing, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. We get adventure resumes from them. We have a vetting committee. I ask a lot of questions. We look at the boats, the people, the makeup, their intentions. You know, a lot of it comes from the gut, and we have to put a lot of faith in these people, so we do try and know them very well.
Okay. And as for the Port Townsend community, how can we be involved?
Coming down and representing is really great at the Ruckus. The Ruckus is the pre-race party the day before. It starts at 3 o'clock. There's food, there's a beer garden, there's going to be music, there's going to be boats that are on the hard. And it's right next to the Maritime Center where it all happens. It goes from 3 to 8. Volunteering to be part of the Ruckus is really great, too. And you can find out more about the Ruckus or volunteer on the website at r2ak.com, which is a wonderful thing to do. Also, just getting the word out about the race and getting people who are interested to know where to come and know what to see. We're holding a glitterati event. It's kind of like a VIP for people, too, which you can find out more at the race. But it does involve an exclusive balcony viewing of the start with complimentary mimosas and really cool bowling T-shirts.
Ah, okay. Well, that's very attractive. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And now people can follow it online even now, right? You can go on there, find out all the details.
That's right. The team bios are, I think, people's hands-down favorite thing to read. And it's hard to describe, but you should just really get on r2ak.com and go to the team bios. They're both hilarious, somewhat true, somewhat a good story.
They're loosely based on facts.
Loosely based on fact. And then when the race starts, we have a tracker up. All the boats carry a tracker that I give them. And 24 hours a day, you can look on that tracker and you can find out where those boats are throughout the entire race course. So you can follow it online.
So you can follow your favorite.
Absolutely.
One of my friends was very interested in the Canadian team from last year.
Soggy Beaver.
The Soggy Beaver. Now, are they returning?
No, they're not returning.
She will be very sad to hear that.
I think it's going to break many a person's heart, indeed. Some good-looking young men on that boat.
Apparently so. And so you can follow your favorite team as much as you want?
Yes, you can follow your favorite team as much as you want. And we will be compiling like social media and video clips and things of all the teams day-to-day as we're able to pick them up. And get them onto the website.
You know, we're running really tight on time, but I did want to get a few points out there so people understand this. Safety is very important in this race, and there is a follow boat that comes along.
Grim Reaper.
Yes, the Grim Reaper. And if someone is in trouble, they can get rescued. You had some air support last year, right?
They get rescued by the Standard Professional Rescue. We're not a rescue company, so the Canadians most likely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Last year, there were no real injuries. Everyone came out happy and healthy. And I also understand that the steak knives went further than they expected. Just tell us that little vignette.
Well, I mean, the steak knives ended up second place, got the lovely steak knives, and they had the grace to share them with third place because after 750 miles, second and third place was decided in a 9-minute difference in a rowing race, which
is
incredible.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
It's very exciting. The race to Alaska, June 23rd, and you can go down and watch them get in the water.
Oh, please do. Absolutely.
What time is that?
The race start is at 6 a.m. People can show up. People last year showed up a half hour to an hour earlier because all the boats are out there sailing. Jefferson Healthcare will be out there paddling, Aaron Stark too, giving out oatmeal to racers. I hear that there is maybe a skinny dip, unauthorized skinny dip that might go on. But yeah,
I'm shocked.
A ton of people came down last year, so it was a great time. And then the day before the 22nd is the Ruckus.
Okay, the Ruckus on the 22nd, the beginning of the race, early morning, everyone set your alarm. Thank you for being a guest on the show. I'm really sorry to tell you, but we're out of town. My name is Marianne McNellis. You've been listening to Our Town on KPTZ. It's a show that features some of the wild, weird, and wonderful people who live and work in beautiful Jefferson County. My guest today, Daniel Evans, who's the race boss for the upcoming Race to Alaska. And I hope everyone shows up. And don't forget, you can follow the action online. Meanwhile, keep listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend, for more dynamic, eclectic community radio.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production created by Marianne McNellis and engineered by John McPherson.